Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This episode is brought to you by Paramount Plus. Get in, loser! Mean Girls is now streaming on Paramount Plus. Join Katie Heron as she meets the plastics in Tina Fey's new twist on the modern classic. Get ready for more of the rumors, backstabbing, and jokes you loved from the original movie with some fetch surprises. Rated PG-13. Wear pink and head to ParamountPlus.com to try it free.
What's going on, everybody? Hope you are doing good. This is the first time, if you're watching on YouTube, this is the first time I've actually done a video intro, which is weird to me because I'm looking at a screen and also looking at a camera. It's very strange. If you're listening on Spotify or Apple, then pay zero attention to me. Anyway, thank you for listening to this podcast. It means the world. I think I have just recorded... I'm just checking, 199 episodes. So we're nearly at 200, which is absolutely crazy to me. So first of all, thank you. If this is your first time listening to the podcast, I'd love it if you could subscribe, if you could get involved. It would mean the world if you did that, or just gave us a little review. Keeps the podcast going. So I'm going to stop blabbering on. This week's interview is quite possibly, I'll be honest, I was well nervous. Moby doesn't really need any introduction. Moby is one of the reasons why I am in electronic music. He's one of my favorite artists ever. He has had extreme success when it comes to releasing electronic, ambient, orchestral, and all the in-between punk rock. A lot of you would have heard his records over the years. Honey, Porcelain, Go, Why Does My Heart Feel So Bad? I didn't know what to expect when I got him on the podcast, and I was very surprised when they agreed, or when he agreed to come on. Absolutely loved this episode. We go from history of where it all started for him, his punk rock days, into extreme success, into sobriety, and everything in between. I really, really enjoyed this episode. So, without further ado, Moby, how are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Yeah, I'm really good, thank you. I'm really good. Thanks for coming on. It means a lot to have you on the show. I'm really fortunate to get to speak to a lot of people in the music industry, and having you on is, well, I've been a huge fan for God knows how many years. So being able to sit down and have a conversation with you, I do really appreciate that, and I'm really excited to dig into what we're going to dig into. So thank you for that.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Whereabouts in the world are you?
I'm at home in Los Angeles. I moved here about 14 years ago.
Nice. How are you finding it?
the good stuff is great, and the terrible stuff you just have to make a concerted effort to avoid. Strangely enough, one of the reasons I moved to Los Angeles was simply to be able to go hiking in the wintertime. I know most people, you know, move to Los Angeles for parties or glamour or
Hollywood
showbiz or celebrity. And for me, I basically moved here for like trees.
Makes sense. Makes complete sense. Yeah. LA's, I used to live in Silver Lake, or Silver Lake Echo Park area. And I only lasted like 4 or 5 months. It's not my favorite. But I ended up, I'm in the UK at the moment, but I ended up in Detroit of all places. Been back and forth in Detroit for the last 6 or 7 years now.
I mean, I've heard Los Angeles described as Detroit with palm trees.
Especially nowadays, 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's definitely interesting. How's your year been?
This year, wow, I don't even know. It's such a good, relevant question. And I have no idea what, I mean, like, I feel like the combination of getting older and living in Los Angeles and also the, you know, sort of like the ongoing lingering effects of the pandemic, I feel like time, like the Orbital song, like time has become a loop. Like, yeah. I don't even, as bizarre as this sounds, I don't even really know what a year is. It's like a year ago, I don't know what I was doing. I don't know if that's a fugue state or I'm just content to like walk around and listen to music and look at trees, but I have no idea what the last year even involved.
I get that, because there comes a point, I've had this many times on the here and kind of just in generally in life, when you start talking about when things were, and I truly think the pandemic just kind of put a hole into time and how did we even get to like where we're at today. So much has happened since then and so much happened before then and so much didn't happen in the middle, and it's like, what, where did that time go?
And then for me it's compounded by the Los Angeles thing of the fact that the seasons here don't make any sense, you know, like it last year or this year we've been in, like, February was warmer than May and January was sunnier than June. And like, I'm baffled at the passing of time, but luckily right now, selfishly, self-involvedly, like I'm sitting comfortably having a nice chat with you, looking at some trees. My socks are dry, so I have no real complaints.
Life is good. Hey, life is good. I want to talk to you about a lot. I just kind of want to dig into your brain massively. So bear with me. The first subject I really want to hit on is sobriety. I don't drink. But I wouldn't class myself as sober. I haven't drank for 12 odd years purely because I just don't like it. I want to dig deeper into sobriety for you and what it means to you and kind of how that all started.
Okay. I mean, obviously the precursor to sobriety is addiction.
Yeah.
And I first started drinking and doing drugs. This is one of the only things that makes me quasi unique as an addict is I started drinking and doing drugs when I was 10 years old.
Okay.
And by the time I was 13, I had an alcohol problem. Like I was abusing alcohol and I watched a friend of mine almost die because of, you know, alcohol poisoning. This is by the age of 13. And one would think if I were rational that at the age of 13, I would have recognized alcohol was a bad thing. And I, not that it's bad for everyone, it's perfectly great for most people, but for me, I should have recognized that I had a problem with drinking. But of course, given the nature of addiction, it took me another 30 years of experimentation to finally admit that I might have a problem.
Makes complete sense. And also growing up around that era, addiction wasn't really talked about, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. I was actually just having an old person conversation with some friends of mine remembering how different things were growing up, yeah, in some ways better, in some ways worse.
In what ways better?
Well, the better part was the sense of chaos and adventure that my friends and I had when we were growing up, not even referring to alcohol and drugs, but for example, most of my friends who have parents now, they have to legally look after their kids 24 hours a day. They drive their kids to school. They pick up their kids at school. Every minute is structured. And when I was growing up, it was just chaos. Yeah. You know, my friends and I would meet up at 8 a.m. on Saturday morning, and we would ride our bikes around, going to abandoned houses and just going on adventures. And then you come home at 8 o'clock at night, have dinner and go to sleep.
Yeah.
And that sense of autonomy and independence, I feel like that doesn't exist for a lot of kids now, at least not in Los Angeles or parts of the United States, maybe less structured places it does. But like, I really do value the fact that, you know, from the time I was six on, I had autonomy.
Yeah.
You know, you'd leave when you wanted to leave. You'd come home when you wanted to come home. You'd study when you wanted to study. And I'm really weirdly grateful for that. The bad side was, of course, that everybody, including everyone in my family, smoked cigarettes. Everyone drove drunk. There were no seatbelts. So
population control, we used to call it.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's kind of amazing. I mean, I think of like from the time I was 6 years old on, my friends and I just like went wherever we want.
Yeah.
And somehow we survived. Which in hindsight is kind of baffling, like thinking how dangerous the world actually is. Like we would, you know, ride our bikes late at night with our eyes closed. Yeah. We would ride in traffic. We would break into abandoned buildings. We'd break into non-abandoned buildings. We just like, it was just these
being kids,
almost like, yeah, we're just, we were just kids. Yeah. And I feel like kids today, and I know the moment you say kids today, you immediately identify yourself as a very old person, but like kids today don't have that sense of chaotic freedom, yeah, at least not in Los Angeles. So
no, I feel the same. Yeah. Like I'm obviously from the UK. I've got niece and nephews and things like that. And from me, from when I was growing up, I wasn't breaking into abandoned buildings or anything like that because I live in the middle of the countryside in the UK. But like we were up on the hills, we were camping, we were making fires, we were having a laugh as kids. And I think it's completely changed. I think in my personal opinion, what's happened is more people are aware of what's going on in the world. The world's become way smaller, which has kind of coddled the young mind to a certain extent. I guess going into that, kind of tying this into music and art and culture, do you think that changes it? Do you think that the coddling of the younger generations changes art and kind of in the situation where you went when you went through the punk era to like where we're at today? Do you think that kind of influenced it?
Oh, absolutely. And again, things were so different back then. Like, yeah, first of all, when I turned 18 and I was ready to leave home, the world was profoundly inexpensive.
Yeah.
You know, this is going back to the 80s, anybody could live in any, you could live in London, you could live in Berlin, you could live in New York, you could live in Los Angeles. All these places were so cheap.
Yeah.
And as a result, artists, musicians, writers would move to Manhattan, would move to London, would move anywhere. And you didn't have to worry about paying the rent because the rent was so incredibly inexpensive because these cities were dirty and dangerous and no one wanted to live there.
Yeah.
And that was such a remarkable incubator for creative talent.
Mm.
You know, it didn't matter if you were a writer, film director, choreographer, musician, what have you, you'd move to one of these cities and you would spend years surrounded by other creatives figuring out how to do what you wanted to do.
Yeah.
And that, it's so tragic, that doesn't exist anymore. Like, I don't know where young creatives go.
TikTok.
Yeah, TikTok and their parents' front rooms. But that is really heartbreaking, the fact that like no one can afford to live in these cities anymore. And back then, every city Los Angeles, San Francisco, Seattle, Detroit.
Yeah.
I mean, Detroit, I guess, still is one of the last remaining places where people can sort of afford to pay the rent and develop their skills as creatives.
It's one of the reasons. Certainly, why, it's definitely one of the reasons. Sorry to buy in. It's definitely one of the reasons why I moved to Detroit at that time in my career, where I was like, I was a touring artist, but I realistically didn't want to afford to live in New York or live in LA. Yeah. But I had to be in the US because that was where all my touring was.
By the way, just FYI, I'm doing something that hopefully won't screw up our interview. And it's a sad admission. I'm in the process of making soup.
So oh, wow. No, that's fine.
I'm walking to my kitchen to make sure that nothing's burning. And I apologize. I might even, let me turn off something just to make sure.
What soup are you making?
Okay, so we were talking about the pandemic, and basically, and this dovetails to the pandemic and also how cheap things used to be in big cities.
Yeah.
So in the, I guess around 1987, I moved into an abandoned factory in a cracked neighborhood, and I was a squatter. I mean, to be fair, I gave the security guard who looked after the abandoned factory complex $30 a month to sort of look the other way. But so I lived in this abandoned factory with tons of other artists and weirdos, and it was completely unsafe.
What city was this in, sorry?
What's that?
What city was this in?
Oh, this was in Stamford, Connecticut.
Okay.
So it wasn't even the glamour of New York. I was on my way to move to New York, but yeah. Stamford, Connecticut, and I didn't have running water. I didn't have a bathroom, but I had free electricity so I could work on music. Mm. And I was also at the time making around $2,000 a year. So I was broke.
Yeah.
And one of the things I had to do to feed myself as a vegan back then was cook. And so I started making the most inexpensive soup I could make, which was basically beans, onions, carrots, potatoes, like where each bowl of soup really cost around 20 cents. And when the pandemic started, I realized I could no longer go out to restaurants. And I thought to myself, okay, I need to start cooking again. And I remembered this abandoned factory soup I used to make. And what's interesting is at the time in the 80s, I made it because it was so cheap and delicious and filling. But now I realize it's also one of the healthiest things I could possibly eat. So it's like black beans, pinto beans, kale, dandelion greens, onions, scallions, potatoes, carrots. And I was like, so it's still incredibly inexpensive, but now I know it's also one of the healthiest things I've ever put in my body.
Happy days. I think there's also a level of like, it goes back to that inexpensive stuff. It's like, eating out is so expensive nowadays. No, even if you have all the money in the world, right? Eating out is still extremely expensive, especially in these major cities. And there's something about eating healthy and cooking at home is super important. I love cooking. It's like the one thing that kind of escapes me from reality, if I'm honest.
Yeah, and it's funny because as a vegan, a lot of times people will say, well, veganism is elitist and only rich people can afford to be vegan. And I was like, really? Have you looked at black beans recently?
Comes out of the ground.
A pound of black beans costs like $1 and it'll feed you for a month. Like I mean, sure, if you want to go to very wonderful high-end vegan restaurants, that's very expensive. But if you stay home and make brown rice and black beans and broccoli, like it might not be the most glamorous meal, but it costs nothing and it will feed you and keep you alive.
Yeah, definitely. And you can make batches of that stuff and it will last for forever. Yeah, definitely. So I want to go back to living in a warehouse, starting to write music. The punk rock era. I really want to dive into this because it wasn't an era that I grew up in. I'm massively into it. But I kind of want to get into like, how did you get into that? The punk rock era, like what did it mean? What does punk mean to you?
Well, and I remember the first two times I was exposed to punk rock. One was there was a weird radio station coming out of New York that I used to listen to when I was, I don't know, 11 or 12 years old. I think it was called WNEW. And because I was a sad, lonely child, I would spend a lot of time just listening to the radio and taping things off the radio. To be clear, taping things off the radio meant holding my grandfather's dictaphone up to the speaker on a transistor radio and recording it that way.
Amazing.
So it wasn't fancy. It wasn't like taping on an actual tape deck connected to a stereo. It was being a sad little 12-year-old holding his grandfather's old dictaphone recorder up to a tiny little speaker. But that was the best I could do. And the DJ played I Fought the Law by The Clash.
Yeah.
And I was like, what is this? This is, I just remember thinking like, this is different. Like this, I knew it was guitars and drums. And I knew it was, you know, it was similar to rock music, but it was so much more energetic and just had this exuberance to it. Yeah. And then the second time I was exposed to punk rock is my mom and I went to go see this weird movie called Mr. Mike's Mondo Video. And Mr. Mike was a writer for Saturday Night Live, and he released this movie that was just a clip show.
Yeah.
So he found some of his favorite videos and compiled them into a movie. And one of the videos was Sid Vicious singing My Way.
Yeah.
And it would, between hearing The Clash, I Fought the Law, and seeing Sid Vicious sing My Way, I was like, oh, this is new. This is interesting. This is so exciting. But the school that I went to, we weren't allowed to like punk rock by the other students. The other students were into, you know, the Grateful Dead. They were into classic rock.
Yeah.
And they made it very clear that, like, if you had short hair, if you listened to new wave or punk rock, they were going to beat you up. So my friends and I were these closeted punk rock new wave kids, you know, listening to early Talking Heads, listening to The Clash and the Sex Pistols and early Gang of Four, but not really being courageous enough to advertise it to the other kids in school. And then I guess it was around 1981 or 82, we all had this moment of courage and we cut our hair short and we started a band and we became unapologetic punk rock new wave kids. And sure, it meant we got pushed into lockers in high school,
yeah,
but we were finally able to live, like we had the courage of our convictions finally.
Was that the Vatican Commandos? Is that at that point?
Yeah, that was, we'd started this punk rock band and we finally were like, you know what? We had such contempt for the status quo that sort of emboldened us, that gave us the bravery to wear, you know, to cut our hair really short and wear punk rock shirts, you know, t-shirts to school, because we were like, you know what? Why would we, and I guess this is even true now, like, why accommodate a status quo for which you have contempt?
Totally. On Spotify, when I type in that, there's two records that come up, Carry It Forward and is that one of your records or not?
No, weirdly, the only record I played on from the Vatican Commandos was called Hit Squad for God.
Okay.
And it was a little, like, I think 5-song EP, maybe 6 songs EP that we recorded in 1982 and released in 1983. And I hadn't listened to it in forever. And I actually went back a while ago and listened to it. And I was like, wow, this is actually so much better than I thought it was. So they made a few other records and they toured a bit, but that was after I had left the band.
Yeah, because I was listening to it earlier. And I there was only two records on Spotify, and I think, well, let me just pull it up. Yeah, Things Are Not the Same and Carry It Forward. Those are the only two.
Yeah, so Hit Squad for God was the only Vatican Commando. That's definitely, I'm pretty sure it's on YouTube. I don't know where else it would live.
So how do we go from punk rock to writing rave music? Talk me through that process.
So here's the thing, in New York especially, you know, like this moment, the moment my friends and I turned 15, we started going to concerts in New York by ourselves. Yeah. Like we would sneak out of the house and get on the Metro North suburban train. And to avoid paying the fare, we would hide in the bathroom. And so we were these, you know, 4 or 5, 15-year-old scared little suburban kids in New York in the early 80s, going to the Mud Club, going to CB's, going to A7, going to the Peppermint Lounge and Danceteria. And we were so in love with everything that was happening in the world of, we'll call it like alternative music,
yeah,
that we just loved everything. You know, it was kind of almost indiscriminate. Like I loved Joy Division, but I loved Black Flag, and I loved Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, and I also loved Discharge, and I loved reggae, and I loved Nick Drake. Like anything that was alternative was so interesting. And the other thing I'll say is that period in New York nightlife was so eclectic. Like you would go to a club like Danceteria to see the Bad Brains.
Yeah.
You know, or to see a band like Mission of Burma. And then it was this multi-story nightclub, and there'd be a hip hop DJ on one floor, there'd be a gay disco DJ on another floor, there'd be a new wave gothic video DJ on another floor. So you would just walk up and down and be exposed to all this music. And so there was never, at least for my friends and I, there was never a compelling reason to choose one specific genre over another. Mm. And the other, I mean, even some of the music that came out of that period reflected that eclecticism. I mean, totally. I think of a band like Killing Joke,
yeah.
You know, like Killing Joke were this aggressive guitar driven punk rock band who also used drum machines and sequencers.
Yeah. It's really interesting though, isn't it? Because
so basically it was that ethos of eclecticism that was so unbelievably exciting at that time.
Yeah, because it's really interesting. I was obviously I know a lot of your music, but I was going back earlier to like a lot of the back catalog. Did you spend much time in the UK at like in your early years, but when you were starting to write Moby?
The first time I came to the UK, I remember it incredibly well. It was the summer of 19... Wait, let me think. Okay, maybe I don't remember it as well as I thought I did. I believe it was the summer of 1990.
Yeah.
And I had just released one single under my name, which was... the A side was Mobility, yeah. And the B side was the song Go. Mm-hmm. And I somehow managed to book myself some DJ gigs in Amsterdam, in parts of Germany, and in the UK. And also I brought my keyboard, so I was also doing some like live, like, well, quote unquote live, yeah, events, which was, you know, me with a drum machine and a DAT and a keyboard. And that was my introduction to the UK. And what was really funny, hopefully, I think it's mildly funny now, maybe as a resident of the UK, you'll think it's funny, is my friends and I were staying in Wood Green.
Yeah.
And we didn't know what that was. We thought that was the center of London. And we were so confused that how this like sleepy little place, we're like, what is this, London? Like, there's nothing going on. And then someone said, no, London, like actual where you want to go is 45 minutes away on the night bus. And yeah. I was like, okay. So we spent a lot of time on that night bus going back and forth to Wood Green.
I love that. Yeah, because I guess the reason for my question is Go is obviously extremely rave influenced in my eyes. And you tell me if it's not for you, but where were you hearing that in America to kind of be influenced by that? Or were you listening to it? It feels very UK to me.
Yeah. I mean, it was record stores. I mean, Vinyl Mania, Dance Tracks. I mean, you know, I started DJing in the mid 80s and I just would spend all my money on records.
Yeah.
And so you'd go to record stores and not really, because I didn't have access to like the music press. Mm. You only had access to record stores and other nightclubs.
Yeah.
And at that time, I didn't know the difference between house music and techno. You know, this is 1988.
Yeah.
And so when you heard Inner City, you know, Good Life, I was like, someone would say, oh, that's a techno track. I was like, but it's a house track.
Yeah.
Or Strings of Life by Derek May. I'd be like, well, this is house music. And someone would say, no, actually, it's from Detroit. It's techno. It's like, okay, I don't really know what that means, but sure. And then by about 1990, I just started having more access to music magazines.
Okay.
And to other DJs in this community. I mean, this was before the internet, so it was all word of mouth. And we just started slowly finding out about these different genres. Mm. And then, you know, this, I mean, 1990, I'm trying to think, it was like the beginning of, we'll call it like the divergence of the BPMs.
Yeah.
And what I mean, you'll understand this perfectly. Most people listening will understand perfectly that up until about 1990, house music and techno were roughly the same speed. Like house music was 122 beats per minute, techno was 124. So you could very easily go from Marshall Jefferson house music anthem into an Inner City track.
Yeah.
And then Belgian techno happened, you know, R&S Records, and suddenly got faster. And then breakbeats started happening and rave music just kept getting faster and faster and faster and faster. And house music became, was still wonderful, but it became even slower. It became more like garage, you know, yeah. Like 120 beats per minute, 119. And I loved everything, but at that point you could no longer play both types of music in a night. Like you couldn't go to stay as a, and I'm stating the obvious to you and most yeah. people listening, you can't really play 134 BPM Belgian techno track and then go to 118 BPM deep house track.
No, 100%.
So you can love both of them, but you could no longer as a DJ play both in the same night.
But this is where it kind of, for me, it amazes me how you've kind of curated your career, because you're known for rave, for that rave kind of techno, from in my eyes, okay? And in my opinion, but you also have your electronica, you have your ambient projects, you have beautiful piano pieces. And realistically, as you're very aware, but in this industry, in the electronic music industry, it feels like people are pigeonholed into one genre and that's all they do. And they don't step out of the kind of the realm of making anything else or releasing anything else under their artist. We all make mm-hmm. stuff, right? But a lot of the time we are, okay, I'm a techno artist, I release just techno. How did you kind of build yourself as an artist where you were actually more of an artist, not a DJ producer, if that makes sense?
Well, a part of it was just my weird background of, like, you know, when I was very, very young, I studied classical music and music theory.
Yeah.
And then that segued into punk rock and new wave, and that segued into hip hop, and that segued into electronic music. And I just had such deep love for all of these genres. And also a lot of my heroes at the time experimented wildly. I mean, you think of like The Clash, like yeah. Joe Strummer was in a punk rock band, but they played reggae, they played hip hop, they did so many different things. David Bowie, same thing. John Lennon, you know, there was just this sense of, I was like, okay, my heroes are experimenting.
Yeah.
And I'm hanging out in New York and I'm going to Danceteria where the hip hop DJ is on one floor and the gay disco is above that and the punk rock bands in the basement. That eclecticism just seemed so interesting. So when I started making records under my own name, yeah, there was quite a lot of pressure to just do one thing.
Yeah.
From, you know, the people I worked with, et cetera. Definitely, I was not encouraged to be so weird.
Yeah.
And so confusing. It's kind of amazing to me that I wasn't dropped for more record labels or, you know, because... Yeah, I mean, like when I made the album Animal Rights, which is this weird industrial yeah. punk rock record, Daniel Miller, who owned Mute Records, to his credit, he didn't like it.
Yeah.
He didn't want me to release it, but he supported me in releasing it. And he said, you know what? Okay, if this is what you have to do, this is what you have to do. And I just thought it was part of the job description that, like, art, you know, artists, musicians are supposed to experiment and supposed to try different things. And it's only in hindsight that I've realized that the smart musicians pick one thing and stick with it. You know, Metallica became a heavy metal band in the early 80s. They've never not been a heavy metal band. And boy, oh boy, look at how it served their career. You know, look at, I mean, like, and then, sorry, I'm rambling on like a crazy person, but then I look at a band like the Chemical Brothers.
Yeah.
And what they've done that's so clever is they've experimented, like they've incorporated so many different musical elements in what they do, but always within the realm of electronic dance music, which is very kudos to them for figuring out how to both experiment but never confuse people.
Yeah, because I you hit the nail on the head, but there's also something very romantic about a Moby album dropping and me going to listen and not having a fucking clue what's going to be on this album. And there's something beautiful about that. And I think that's what you've created as an artist. Whereas the Chemical Brothers are, again, the reason, one of the reasons why I do what I do. However, I know exactly what I'm going to get with a Chemical Brother album. And
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I don't know what's, I don't know, there's no right or wrongs.
Yeah, I mean, what I will say is I wish I could give myself a little bit more credit for having a clue what I was doing.
Yeah.
Like there was no, you know, for example, like when the album Play became successful, I would do interviews and people would ask me about the strategy. It's like, I don't know. I made this record in my bedroom and people liked it. Like there was no strategy. So that eclecticism that you're referring to, it was just the product of enthusiastic cluelessness on my part. Like it wasn't, you know, there's no career plan. There's no strategy. It's just simply, I don't know, almost like a clueless dimwittedness on my part. Like, hey, I want to make a punk rock record. And the people around me saying, you know, that's going to alienate everybody who listens to your music. I was like, yeah, okay, so I'll do it anyway. Like, it's honestly, like, one could say, like, I love the fact that I've been able to experiment this much and be so eclectic, but it definitely at times has veered into the realm of the clueless and stupid.
And I really, that kind of links back to the punk era, right? That links back to being more of a punk artist than, because punk is more so about just doing what you want to do and being part of the culture rather than being commercial to a certain extent.
Yeah, and the ethos of challenge.
Yeah.
You know, pushing, like, and I'm not saying I'm good at anything and I'm not saying I did this effectively, but, you know, the 20th century was filled, and going back even further, but especially the 20th century, the most interesting artistic movements were confrontational.
Agreed.
You know, whether it was, you know, the Situationists or Fluxus or Dada or the Surrealists or the Minimalists, like it's, there's always been, even whether it's John Coltrane or Public Enemy, there's this idea of you, you love your audience, but you challenge your audience and you confront the audience, and sometimes you succeed and sometimes you fail. And I just thought, that's so interesting. Like, you know, especially like the situationists or the Dadaists. And I guess what always seemed a little sad to me in a way, and especially now, I think sadly it's even more true, is like, and I don't want to judge, I don't want to criticize, but like when people's first criteria for evaluating their possible creative expression is how does it affect their career?
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, I understand. And I recognize I come from a place of privilege, so my opinion doesn't mean that much there, but I just feel like when career comes before creativity, the results tend to be a little more anemic.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it becomes just very more catered to commercialism, and it's very it's also easy for all of us to sit back on our high horses because we have successful careers in music, but it can be very easily manipulated to create something that sells well to a certain extent.
Yeah.
And creates a career. However, you're a classic example that by doing what you absolutely love can create one of the most influential albums in electronic music. And I think there's that level of being able to be free as an artist. Do you think you can get that nowadays?
I would hope so. I mean, again, I don't trust my opinion on a lot of things because, you know, like I'm a 58-year-old guy who's had a degree of success. So like, it's kind of like if someone asks me what I think about Taylor Swift, I'm like, you know what? I'm not the demographic for that. Like, don't listen to me. Someone asked me what I thought about the Barbie movie. And I was like, why would you ask a 58-year-old guy's opinion about that? Like, I'm not the demographic. Like, so it's again, to your point, it's very easy for me to sit back and say, oh, everyone should, you know, pursue the creative muse and disregard, you know, commerce. I'm like, but that's, I don't trust my opinion about that because other people, you know, people have to pay the rent. People have to, you know, they have sick in-laws. They have to pay off college debt. What I will say, and I can be a little judgmental, so I apologize for being judgmental, is like, what I don't understand are the people who compromise when they don't have to.
Yeah.
You know, like the wealthy musicians who just keep protecting their career when they don't need to. It's like, go out and like use your platform to address politics, to address social issues, to address environmental issues, like experiment creatively. When I see musicians who are worth $100 million being cautious, I'm like, no, that's not the time to be cautious. That's the time to go out into the world and use your platform and your status and your resources to make the world a better, more interesting place. Mm. And that's when I really am like, ugh, I kind of roll my eyes when I watch something like the Grammys and I see these wealthy musicians being safe. I'm like, come on. Like, once you have a degree of financial security and once you have a little bit of a career under your belt, go out and do something interesting with it.
And we did you again, no I don't
that, that's where I can get a little judgmental.
I don't disagree with you. I think as long as an artist is being their authentic self, I think that's the thing, is you don't have to be political, you don't have to be spiritual, you don't have to be any of these things, but if you believe in something, talk about it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's what I mean. I'm not saying that like it's a one size fits all approach towards like activism and creativity, but you know, we just know when, whether it's a politician, whether it's an artist, whether it's a musician, whether it's a whatever, we know when people are being cautious and prioritizing safety and career over authenticity.
Yeah.
You know, and we just know, like everybody knows, and it's, and selfishly, it makes me kind of depressed, because the world doesn't need safe, wealthy musicians protecting their careers. The world needs people experimenting and challenging and using their platforms to do great things. So again, I'm being very judgmental and I apologize, but I just, it really galls me. I guess it's that question, like the deathbed question, like when someone's on their deathbed, what do they want to remember? Do they want to remember being safe? Do they want to remember, you know, like protecting a career so they could buy a fourth house and a private plane? Yeah. Or do they want to remember trying new things and trying to address issues that are important to them in a public sphere? Like, at least that's just my perspective.
Do you think you've ever played it safe?
Oh yeah, I tried and I sucked at it, luckily.
Give me an example, please.
After the album Play, I really wanted to sort of have my cake and eat it too. I wanted to make music that I loved, but I also really wanted to be famous. Yeah. I wanted to play big concerts. I want to get invited to fancy parties. And so the two albums after that, there was a focus on music, but there was also a consideration of career. And the album that to my shame, I did that the most on was this album called Hotel.
Okay.
And that's when I went, in my mind, that's where I compromised my integrity the most. I don't think it's a bad record, but I was definitely thinking about touring. I was thinking about, you know, being signed to a major label. I was thinking about career stuff. And the wonderful thing is the music suffered in a way that made me very aware that the music was suffering and made me then no longer want to prioritize career.
Yeah.
You know, like some people are really good at compromising.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that as a criticism. Like some people are really good at looking at the commercial music marketplace and accommodating it. Luckily for me, I was terrible at it.
Yeah.
So I'm really grateful that I sucked at selling out, because it made it very clear that I should not be spending my time and effort trying to sell out.
I guess the thing is how was your career before Play? And then what was the changes? Like, was it a drastic change from your life before Play and then after?
Oh yeah. It was as drastic can be. I mean, and to put it in context, in 1998, my mother had just died of cancer.
I'm sorry.
I had been dropped from my American record deal. I was going broke. I was battling alcoholism and drug addiction. I was seriously mentally ill. Like, I was having terrible panic attacks and depression and suicidal thoughts. And I thought that my career as a musician had ended. And I was just thinking about, like, finding a bar and drinking myself to death.
Yeah.
And then in 1999, Play was released. And at first it was a failure. Like, it didn't sell very well. It got a couple of good reviews, but for the most part, no one really paid attention to it. And then I can put it in perspective this way. The first show I played in the UK was at the Scala. Do you know Scala in London?
No, I don't know that.
Maybe it's not there anymore, but it was a small venue in King's Cross.
Okay.
Held about 400 people, and I think 150 people came to this show. One really funny thing, the Melody Maker gave it a terrible, the performance gave the show a terrible review. And what's funny about it is they referenced songs that I didn't play, which clearly made me realize the journalists just hated me so much they didn't even come to the show. They just gave me a bad review. So that first show in London, 120, 130 people show up. The last show of the Play tour in the UK was at Wembley Arena, and it sold out so quickly, we had to add a second show at Brixton Academy that sold out in a day.
Wow.
So that was the, and I hope that doesn't sound like I'm bragging. I'm
not
just trying to draw attention to the fact that, like, the circumstances of my life personally, professionally, when Play was released, were completely different than after Play had been around for a while.
And what time span are we talking in, like, the length of the time of from the first Play tour to the Wembley?
18 months.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's actually really interesting as well. And I talk about this with my team a lot, and how music is released now and how music is released was released then. And that it can take 18 months for a record to become successful. Whereas now it feels like if you release a record, if it's not successful in the first 2 weeks, it's game over.
Oh, I mean, a friend of mine, and I don't want to get in trouble by naming names, but a friend of mine was signed to a giant record label a few years ago, one of the big majors. And they really believed that she was going to be this huge pop star. And I believe they spent probably around $750,000making her record, like putting her with the biggest producers, hiring choreographers, hiring hair and makeup people and stylists. They spent close to $1 million getting ready to release her record. The first single didn't connect at radio in the first week and they dropped her.
So scary.
So they gave her 5 days, not even 2 weeks. They gave her 5 days to prove herself. And when it didn't connect at pop radio in the first 5 days, they dropped her.
And so going back to, was it, what year was it? Was it 99 Play was out?
Yeah, Play was released in 1999, May of 1999. So, boy, this makes me feel very old. That means that next year is the 25th anniversary of Play, because I'm a very old person.
I want to talk about the album cover as well. Is the album cover that we will see now still the original album cover?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was because when Play was, when we were, I'd finished the album, Daniel Miller and Mute Records liked it. No one expected it to sell well. And so the artwork, I spent the day walking around New York with a photographer, and she was staying at the Chelsea Hotel. So we went to her room at the Chelsea Hotel and she said, "Hey, jump up and down on the bed and I'll take some pictures." And that's where the record cover came from.
Wow.
That's amazing. And the record was designed, the artwork was designed by my girlfriend at the time, because she was sort of doing me a favor, because I couldn't really afford to hire a graphic designer.
Yeah, it's iconic album cover for me personally. Moving on from Play, you spoke about the albums going into, like, when you're looking at commerce. What was the album after that when you were like, I just need to do me, I just need to do what I want to do, and what was the process behind that mentally as well, and kind of adjusting yourself to, like, okay, this is purely for me?
Oh, by the way, your connection is a little,
is it blurry,
frozen? No, like your audio is sort of, I don't know if it's Wi-Fi or, but your picture is frozen.
Ooh.
It's kind of interesting. You look a little bit like Fidel Castro addressing a rally.
We're good here. We're recording here and it's absolutely fine. So if it's on your, can you hear me still, audio?
Yeah, it's a little bit like, it's
that's weird.
Yeah.
Can you hear me now?
But yeah, I mean, as long as it's okay on your end.
Yeah, it's absolutely fine on my end. The way this records, it records locally here. Yeah, it's absolutely fine my end.
Okay. Then, the album after Play was called 18, and 18, surprisingly enough, had, I mean, some songs I really am very happy with, but it was too long. I mean, there are a few things on there that I probably should have taken off.
Yeah.
And then after that was that I mentioned the compromised album Hotel, which strangely enough did remarkably well in Europe. I mean, it's the best-selling record I've ever had in continental Europe. Mm. But it was also when I was bottoming out as an addict.
Yeah.
So that tour was a really dark, dark tour. You know, it was constant drinking and drug taking. I just became this terrible cliche, and it wasn't fun. It was just dark.
Yeah.
And so at the end of that tour, I actually started thinking about buying a dive bar. I found this dive bar in Williamsburg, and I was going to buy it, and I was going to move into it. And I had had my life planned out. I was going to live in the basement. I'm not kidding. And I was going to go to sleep at 9 a.m. and wake up at 5 p.m., which I believe is how vampires live. And I just thought, okay, you know what? I was so depressed. I was so anxious. I just thought, I'm going to live in the basement of this bar. I'll wake up at 5 p.m. I'll go upstairs, start drinking and doing drugs, and I will do this until I die. And luckily, I ended up somehow getting sober. And the first record I made after getting sober was this album, Wait For Me.
Yeah.
And it was commercially, it did nothing.
Yeah.
But I mean, as far as I can tell, it really was just like a commercial, like it didn't sell well. I don't think it really charted. But it was, I felt like, okay, I'm ignoring the commercial world that I've tried to accommodate. And it just felt so liberating.
Yeah.
You know, to focus on just simple creative expression rather than trying to worry about ticket sales or anything involved. And that was, so the irony there, self-involvedly, is that the metrics, the quantifiable metrics of my career were going downhill, but I'd never been happier with my career as a musician.
Wow. Yeah.
Because I was no longer thinking about the marketplace. I was no longer in any way even aware of, you know, sales, radio play, or what have you. And it just was, and some people might say, like, oh, that's kind of lazy. Like, shouldn't you have been worried about, you know, the commercial aspects of releasing a record? And I was like, no, I just, as mentioned before, I was so bad at trying to accommodate the commercial marketplace. It was really liberating to be able to just sort of ignore it.
Makes sense. Yeah, I actually really liked Wait For Me. It was a really, it's a really interesting album. And again, it goes back to what we were saying earlier, is that it felt like, it goes back not knowing what you're going to release, which I absolutely love every time something comes out, is that it's just very unique every single time.
Yeah, well, it's funny with that one. Well, what I am, a moment that I will give myself, I don't know if pride is the right word, but I kind of pat myself on the back for the first single from that record. I remember going into the record company and saying, here's the first single. It's an instrumental called Shot in the Back of the Head.
Yeah.
And David Lynch has made the video. And the record company looked at me like, excuse me? Wait. And I played it for them, and they're like, there are no vocals. And I was like, yeah, that's by definition. That's what an instrumental is. And you could just tell, like, their bewilderment and exasperation. They were like, why in the world? Like, they're like, we signed you to be a huge multi-million selling artist, and now you want to release a first single that's an instrumental with a strange black and white experimental video from David Lynch. I was like, yeah, it makes sense to me. And who knows if it's good or bad or smart or stupid, but it somehow feels right.
What record label was this?
Oh, at that point, it was Mute Records. Okay. And to be fair, Mute had a lot of experience dealing with weird self-involved artists, but even they were a little challenged at the idea of releasing an instrumental first single from an album with a obscure black and white animated video.
Makes sense. Did you get all of your masters back? Because I go on Spotify and everything's under your own record label.
Yeah, to be honest with you, I don't really fully know. Because I've been making music for such a long time, and I've worked with so many different people and been signed to so many labels, and there's so many compilations and different things, that I don't fully know where my masters live. And now I'm almost embarrassed to admit that, because I feel like I'm a really bad, you know, steward of my catalog. I clearly it's somewhere.
Yeah.
I just don't actually know 100% where it is. And it might even differ from country to country.
Yeah. 100%.
And now you've inspired me to go find out, because I'm embarrassed at being a 58-year-old musician who doesn't know who's actually administering my catalog.
No, because I go on Spotify and everything's on Little Idiot, which is your record label, but I just don't know whether that's just the record label that owned the masters have put on as the label. I don't know, but I was really interested by that, because obviously I know, especially nowadays, we're in the era of people buying catalog. So
yeah, I wish I know, and when we're done talking, I'm going to be a responsible adult and actually endeavor to find out, because yeah, you've reminded me that maybe that would be a good thing for a musician to be aware of.
About a year ago started a podcast. What was the reasoning behind starting a podcast?
Well, part of it was the simple love of communicating with people.
Yeah.
You know, my co-host Lindsay, but also a way of, and I'm sure you've had this experience as well, it's like there is something, and I could understand if someone rolls their eyes when I say this, but there's something potentially that's so special and even precious about podcast conversations, because you tend to have conversations with people you might not otherwise have conversations with.
Sorry.
And it's not like a quick 3-minute thing. Like it, in our case, like it's an hour of an in-depth conversation. And another thing that I love about the podcast space is people listen.
Yeah.
You know, so when we're interviewing people, we listen. You know, it's an hour or 90 minutes of like sitting and listening to people and hearing people talk about things that are profoundly important to them.
Yeah.
You know, and having these, like, it's basically encounters with humans that you otherwise would never have. Mm. Like, even like, for example, the most recent episode of Moby Pod was with Hunter Biden, and Hunter is an old friend of mine. I knew him. I know him from recovery. But most of the time when we hang out, we have ridiculous conversations.
Yeah.
You know, we play ping pong, we drink bad coffee, we talk about nonsense. But sitting down and quote unquote interviewing him for the podcast, we had the most meaningful conversation we've ever had. Mm. So that's the main reason for doing it. Is that to have this, you know, potentially significant, meaningful conversations with people that you otherwise would never have. But the other aspect is, as we all know, social media platforms are very confusing.
Yeah.
Like, I can't figure them out. Like, 1 minute Instagram lets you put photos, then it's carousels of photos, then it's videos, then it's not videos, then it is videos, then it's this. And like the algorithms for all the social media platforms, I can't understand them, nor do I want to understand them.
Yeah.
So I felt like, okay, if you want to reach people insofar as you can, you should probably try and create a platform that is not reliant upon algorithms.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I love podcast platform. It's mm-hmm. There's something really special about it, and I think you hit the nail on the head. But for me, the main thing is having long form conversations. Like, I love speaking to people, but it's that long form conversation without any distractions is so important to me. And I think in a world full of distractions, you and I would never have had this conversation if it wasn't for a podcast. Like, the likelihood of me and you coming across each other maybe in a live setting, but I can guarantee you, if you're playing a festival or a show, I'm playing a festival or a show, I might bump into you, say hi, introduce myself, then we never have a conversation. As touring artists, we're all, even in green rooms, even in festivals, even when we're in places for long periods of time, none of us are having conversations unless we're close friends.
Or the conversations, and I'm sure you've had a few million of these, as have I, Like, you're in the green room, you're backstage, it's cold, it's muddy, it's late, and the conversation consists of like, oh, where are you staying?
Yeah.
What time's your flight? Have you seen the new episode of Game of Thrones? And beyond that, that's it. You know, it's like, even people I connect with and care about, we tend to have lighthearted, relatively insignificant conversations.
Yeah.
And it's funny because, as we both know, there are a trillion podcasts in the world.
Yeah.
You know, and so a lot of people are sort of dismissive of podcasts as being this ubiquitous, cheap space. Whereas I actually believe that it has the potential to be profound and significant. All, everything you just mentioned, like long conversations where there's connection and there's meaning and people are really doing their best to like address the things that are important to them. And so as a result, I am, you know, fully on board with the sort of the potential, I don't know, profundity of podcasting.
No, I absolutely love it. I absolutely love it. And I didn't even realize you had a podcast until like a couple of hours ago. So I'm looking forward to digging into that and kind of checking it out. Moby, we've just done an hour. I don't want to take up too much of your time, but just before we kind of end up, music plans. I know you're releasing a lot of like ambience and remakes of your older music at this moment in time. Is there anything in the works? Is there any more music you're working on? How can we expect anything?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. At the beginning of our conversation, you asked me about the last year. And so I've had an hour to sort of think about it. And I realized the last year I've actually released a ton of music.
A lot.
I released my first movie at the beginning of the year. It's called Punk Rock Vegan Movie.
It's great. I've started watching that and it's great.
Oh, thanks. Well, we gave it away for free on YouTube. So that way anyone anywhere can watch it, download it, whatever, like it's free. And then I made my second orchestral greatest hits with Deutsche Grammophon. It's called Resound. And I started this project a couple of years ago called Always Centered at Night, where I do collaborations with different vocalists. And we've released a bunch of music on that with everyone from Serpent with Feet. The next song is going to be with Lady Blackbird.
Yeah.
And it's very sort of like, I'll call it like underground dance inspired music. And
that's interesting.
But the broader thing is something has happened over the last, I don't know, 5 to 10 years. And I think this will resonate with you and probably with a lot of people listening, is I've realized that my approach to music has changed very, very different. It's become a very different thing, where now it's the act of making music that I'm in love with. Mm. It's the refuge of being in a studio, working on music, and then if you release it, that's great.
Yeah.
And if people like it, that's great. But for me, it's the sanctuary, the refuge of being in a studio and working on music. And that to me is the most precious aspect of the world of music. And the wonderful thing about that is, if I make music and no one likes it and no one listens to it or no one pays for it or pays attention to it, I've still found this sanctuary, this refuge that is not contingent upon the opinions of other people. It's not reliant upon the opinions of other people. It's my, and maybe this sounds selfish, but it's my refuge. It's my sanctuary of just going into a studio at night or during the day and being by myself and working on music and listening to music. I feel incredibly fortunate that I get to spend so much of my time in the refuge of a music studio.
It's really interesting you say that, because I think at the end of the day, a lot of what we do can, a lot of that can be lost. And it can be lost in gigs, money, most of it, let's be honest, it's a lot of it's lost in money and commercialism and trying to set up a life for ourselves so that we're financially successful. But for me, what you've just said is a beautiful way to end this, because that for me is success. And it kind of goes back to that caveman mentality of us, is we're just doing it because we absolutely love it. And
yeah,
that's so beautiful. I love that.
Well, it's funny is about 10 years ago, I got asked to be a part of a disgusting tech panel. And the name of the panel, oh, it's so grotesque. The name of the panel was like monetizing digital strategy in the 21st century. And I did this as a favor to a friend of mine. I was like, sure, I hate this, but I'll do it. And for the entire panel, I sat there and said nothing and stared at the floor and just wanted to be anywhere else. Mm. And all these other people were talking about like how to like maximize digital revenue and all this stuff. And finally, at the end, the moderator realized I hadn't said anything and was just being autistic and staring at the floor. And he said, well, Moby, what do you think? And all I could say was, I've never bought anything in my life that has brought me the joy and transcendent emotions I feel when I listen to David Bowie's Heroes, which costs nothing.
Yeah.
And I was like, so why would I of course, money is a necessary evil. We need to pay the rent, to buy sweaters and food and things. But the, you know, like when we can listen to music or go be in nature or be with friends or family or animals and it doesn't cost anything, why prioritize, like, and again, I'm not dismissing money or other people's financial concerns, but what can you buy with money that is better than listening to Heroes by David Bowie? And my answer is nothing.
Yeah.
So it's this liberation of recognizing like the commercial aspects of music, they're there, we can pay attention to them, but ultimately music has the potential to be this transcendent, transformational sanctuary. And I just feel like that's where I have to keep my focus.
Well, and I think it's also really, it's really nice to hear that from coming from you as well, because at the end of the day, well, I'm sure there's a lots of people in this, to be fair, but I can only speak for myself. I didn't get into writing music to become wealthy. I got into writing music and DJing because I absolutely love playing records to people in clubs, and I love making records that I can then go and play to people in clubs, or I love the process of making music. And I think that
as long as we keep the focus on that, I don't want to be naive, but a lot of the other stuff tends to look after itself.
I agree.
As long as the focus is on the joyful love of making music and sharing it with other people.
Perfect way to end. Moby, thank you so much for that, man. I really appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. And it is really funny that your image has been frozen for the last 40 minutes.
Is it really?
You really do look like a sort of Anglo Fidel Castro.
From Lord of the Rings. No, thank you so much, man. I'm really excited for people to listen to this episode. Keep it up, and hopefully we can catch up in person at some point.
I hope so as well. Yeah, thank you so much for inviting me on. This has been wonderful.
Anytime. Keep safe.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And that is a wrap. Big love to everybody for coming on. Keep safe. Please hit subscribe. Please give us a review. Share it with your friends. And I will see you next time.
Every day, we rise, challenging ourselves to work for what we believe in. At U.S. Border Patrol, protecting our borders is more than a job. It's a calling. Agents answer the call, working together to keep our country and communities safe. If you are ready for a new mission, join U.S. Border Patrol and go beyond. Learn more at cbp.gov/careers.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays.
Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.